He was so supportive of you, but then you were very supportive of him. Tell us the story.
Well, John had a master's degree in social welfare from University of California, Berkeley, so he was a very smart guy. He was also fascinated by personal training, so he was in great shape. He was very, very, very active. And then in November of 2010, he noticed that he was getting weaker. You know, he'd go out running with neighbors, and he all of a sudden got to the point he couldn't run any longer. And he thought, because of his training and so forth, that it was a spine issue. So it got progressively worse, and then finally had an appointment with a neurosurgeon and meeting with a neurologist, and was diagnosed with ALS in August of 2011.
This was devastating to both of you.
It was as though someone had taken a 2x4 and whacked us in the head.
What were some of his symptoms?
Basically, his was limb onset, so it was mainly in his legs. He just lost the use of his legs like he previously had been able to use. And then it started working its way into his arms as well.
And then finally into his lungs?
And then finally into his lungs, yes.
We should say, of course, it's also known as Lou Gehrig's disease. Lou Gehrig played for the Yankees baseball team. He had a record of most consecutive games played, 2,130. Took himself out of the lineup May 2nd of 1939 because of symptoms of ALS. And he retired at 36 and was the cause of his death 2 years later.
Right.
About ALS, talk to us about what it is.
Well, basically, your brain stays intact and flourishing, but the connection between the brain and the nerves that go and fire muscles, if you will, become problematic. There's a disconnect there that occurs. ALS strikes in many, many, many different ways. I've known people that have limb onset, which is what John has and what I have, in which, you know, you start maybe tripping or you start dragging your feet, and then all of a sudden one of your arms, maybe you can't grip it, you don't have any strength left in your arm, that sort of thing. Then there's also what is called the bulbar onset, which affects your lungs and your breathing as a result, and also your swallowing and your functions from the neck down. So it affects many, many, many different ways.
The cause is not really known in most cases, is
that it? It is not. They say about 10% of the cases that are diagnosed are from family, you know, gene connections. But other than that, they don't really know at this point what causes ALS.
And to find out if it is ALS, don't they do testing for everything else?
A lot of times it becomes ALS is the only thing left. They've ruled out everything else. Parkinson's or MS or, you know, whatever. And ALS is a difficult disease to diagnose.
So from 2010, when he was feeling the symptoms, how long then before he died?
He died at the end of February 2013.
So 2.5 years.
Yeah.
And you were his caregiver.
Yes. We had 2 and 3 ladies that would come in the morning preparing for the day, be there through the day. I would then come home the early evening, and then another wonderful angel came and took care of him in the evening. And I was there during the night. So if he needed something, like one of the big problems with ALS is saliva collects in your throat and you don't have the strength or the energy to swallow. So it has to be suctioned out. So I'd have to get up during the night sometimes and do that.
Will it always journey to the lungs, no matter where it comes on?
Yeah, eventually, yes.
And some start immediately in the lungs.
Yes.
And their life is not as long.
Usually that's the case. Now, you can have a tracheotomy done, and that will prolong. It's like Stephen Hawking, you know, the British physicist, was diagnosed 50 years ago with ALS, but he has 24/7 care, and he also has a tracheotomy. And with that, you can, you know, live pretty much indefinitely, but he's in a power chair and has to be cared for constantly.
There are many diseases that could be called cruel, but this is, I'm sure you're thinking, it's got to be one of the most cruel.
In my opinion, yes, because your brain is not affected. You're still very aware of what's going on around you. It's just your body quits working.
Did you have computer equipment for John so he could communicate?
Yes, we had an eye gaze computer. So simply by moving the pupils in his eyes, he could type, if you will, on a screen. So he was able to communicate. It took a long time to be able to type out something. There was a button he could look at. He could just change his gaze of his eyes over to the speak button, and the computer would speak for him.
You think about his will to live. You looked at John, how can you continue on?
John had made the comment, he got to the point where he needed a feeding tube. In other words, no longer could swallow things through his throat. So he had to have a feeding tube inserted into his intestinal tract. He said at that point, if you can't eat, what's the point of going on? But the nurses talked him into, you need this for medications, and you don't want to die of dehydration, so you need a way to get fluids into your body and medications to ease pains or for other issues. He agreed to that, but I know that always psychologically bothered him that he could no longer eat.
It's hard to imagine. There are those who perhaps have accidents affecting their spine, and they get frozen, and he's basically then frozen. Right there.
That's correct.
He can just move his eyes.
Right.
And how long a day had to be for him.
Right.
And what were the nights like?
Well, he was able to sleep at night until his throat would fill up and had to be suctioned. But it's pretty sad life.
So then what eventually took him?
It was interesting. He always hoped and prayed for a cure. Therefore, he was hesitant to have hospice come into the house. And finally, he agreed to have the hospice nurses. And I must admit, that's an incredible service and a wonderful, wonderful organization and compassionate, caring people. One of them one day said to me, he'll be gone within a few weeks. He said his internal organs are shutting down. And of course, that's what they're trained to know. I wouldn't have had a clue, but they said he'll be gone in 2 weeks. And sure enough, within a week, he didn't wake up one morning.
And then in addition to hospice, you had a great circle of friends that helped him.
Yes, they came
every day, some of them.
Yeah, in fact, the night before he died, one of my friends and his daughters, who were 8, 9 years old, came over and entertained him because I had a board meeting I needed to attend. And so I went to that and they came over and it was wonderful, the number of people.
So then he died what day?
February 27th, 2013.
This took a big toll on you, too, because the caregiver also is affected by this.
Absolutely. In some respects, it was a blessing that he was gone because he was so unhappy with being in that condition. So in a way, it was a relief. And he had sent me an email. He was able, with his eye gaze computer, to send me emails. And he had sent me an email about 3 weeks before, and he says, I'm ready to go. And he said, what's the point of living in this condition?